From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be wrong to say there is one moral that ties all the stories of the Arabian Nights together. I mean, there are a lot of stories and stories within stories, but you can find lessons in that collection. Ira Glass thinks a lot about stories, and the Arabian Nights helps him explain not only why they work, but the effect they can have on us. Scheherazade tells stories to keep the crazy king from killing her in the morning. He keeps her alive to find out what happens next. But Ira says the stories also change the king. Hearing about the lives of all these different people give him empathy. When a story gets inside us, Ira has said, it makes us less crazy. Today in the program, we're talking about the stories in the Arabian Nights, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the stories in the Arabian Nights. According to the fable, it was stories that saved Scheherazade's life from a vengeful king. She tells him a story one night, and one story leads to another, and another for 1,001 nights, or something like that. The stories she told had stories inside them, and sometimes stories inside that, kind of like a Russian doll. The scholar Robert Irwin says that structure has a counterpart in real life, where, as he writes, we are all of us the stories that we carry within us. Robert Irwin is our guest today. He's joining us to tell the story of the Arabian Nights and what they tell us about the culture that first told them and what they offer today. You can join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Robert Irwin is a scholar of Arabic literature and a novelist. He's in the Department of Languages and Culture of the Middle East at the University of London. He's a consulting editor at the Times Literary Supplement as well. Among his many books on Arabic literature and art is The Arabian Nights, A Companion. He also wrote the introduction for Penguin Classics' three-volume translation of The Arabian Nights. Most recently, he wrote the introduction for the first English translation of a medieval Arab fantasy collection. It's called Tales of the Marvelous and News of the Strange. And Robert Irwin is joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London. Robert Irwin, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
I guess we should begin with your first encounter with these stories. When did you first hear of these stories?
I think, like almost everybody, I encountered them as a child. And these days, very few people do read The Arabian Nights, except in versions that have been composed for children and illustrated for children. But I don't think they made much of an impression on me. It wasn't until I decided that I was going to stop being a lecturer in medieval history and become a novelist. And I picked up a book by Mir Gerhardt called The Art of Storytelling, which was a study of the stories within The Arabian Nights. And I thought, wow, I can really use some of this material to write a novel, which I did eventually produce, called The Arabian Nightmare. And it's kind of pastiche of Arabian Nights themes and stories within stories.
So was that it? The stories within stories? That's the thing. It sounds like there's a corollary there to the story itself, that you just kept getting dragged along by one story after another.
Yeah, I also wanted to give that feeling of that it's a fantasy and that it's a very complex fantasy. And I also wanted to give a sense of urban life. In my novel set in medieval Cairo, the Arabian Nights themselves are very much urban stories. They're not stories of the desert. They're tales that were composed in Baghdad, Cairo, and Damascus. And they reflect the values of basically shopkeepers and artisans, people like that, in the cities.
How do we describe what the Arabian Nights is exactly? I mean, I think some people think of it as a book. Some think of it as fairy tales. But you say it's much more than that.
Oh, yeah. It's not just fairy tales. Indeed, I think in all of the Arabian Nights, there's only one story which features a fairy in it, you know, so we can forget that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are all sorts of stories that which are tales of adventure, of warfare, of piety, of animal fables, tales celebrating the feats of amazing criminals, and tales of, above all, of magic and sorcery and fantasy. It's a huge compendium. Practically every kind of story that was known in the Middle Ages has found its way into the Arabian Nights.
So what do we know about... I mean, I guess there's always this idea, and we'll talk a little bit more about this as we go along, to say that there was one... theme, that there was something that drew it all together, but do you see that in the Arabian Nights?
That's a difficult one. The problem with the Arabian Nights is it's put together over many centuries, and it's impossible to say when the first version existed, came into existence, and it's not even clear that one can say people have finished adding bits to it.
Yeah.
But so... Yes, this business of whether it has a common theme. The core of the Arabian Nights, the oldest stories that have survived substantially, come from a 15th century manuscript. Certainly the stories are older than the 15th century, but they're there in a 15th century manuscript. And if one looks at that manuscript and the content of the stories there, yeah, they have common themes. A lot of it is about repentance for past sins and the themes of... mutilation as a penalty for sinfulness, and of talking for one's life. In the frame story, Scheherazade is talking for her life, telling stories to Sharia, but within her story, there are a whole string of stories where people are talking for their life. Unless they tell a really good story, they're going to get killed by the jinn or executed by the caliph. There are all sorts of themes that knock against one another. It's very artfully composed. Having said that, those are the initial core stories, and they're wonderful. Later on, people just kept adding to the Arabian Nights and saying, oh, well, hang on, we haven't got 1001 Nights here, we better add some more stories. So they grab stories from anywhere, and it becomes a huge dumping ground. Some of the stories that get dumped in the Arabian Nights in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries are very good, really good, but some of them are not so good. And there's no common theme at all in the end. It just goes all over the place. And a lot of people would say that when Scheherazade is telling stories, this is a kind of therapy, and that Shahryar listens and realizes, because Shahryar resolved to kill every woman he slept with, having discovered the unfaithfulness of his wife previously. So he will only sleep with virgins, and once he slept with them for a night, he kills them, lest he be sexually betrayed again. Scheherazade is talking against that, so she never finishes a story, so he lets her live for another day, so here the end of the story, but then she starts another story, and so it goes. Now, a lot of people think that the stories that Scheherazade tells Shahryar teach him tolerance and wisdom and compassion and so on. I'm a bit of a heretic here. I think quite a lot of the stories that Scheherazade tells him are stories about how unfaithful and how crooked and cunning women are, and you know, how to be a despot. And if one actually looks at the end of the Arabian Nights, the final bit, what actually happens, it's shocking to a modern sensibility, is that Shahryar forgives Scheherazade effectively for being a woman. It's a wicked thing in a way.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that framing story, the Scheherazade story, because I think that in of itself is interesting. There's I think you've set it up there. Essentially, Scheherazade, she volunteers to be the next virgin in this, because he's been killing these virgins and then sleeping with them and deflowering them at night and then in the morning killing them. She insists on being the next. She volunteers for this task. What's that about?
Well, she's pretty confident of her storytelling abilities. And she's the vizier's daughter, and she says, I'm going in next. And of course, the vizier doesn't want his daughter to do this. So he starts telling her stories which are intended to dissuade her from doing this. So already we're getting a story within story. As it happens, it strikes me the stories he tells her are completely inappropriate, and it's not surprising that she carries on and decides to go and become Shahryar's next bride. But she takes Dunyazade, her sister, along with her. And it's Dunyazade who seems to be lying under the bed while Shahryar and Scheherazade are having sex. Dunyazade pops up and says, oh, Scheherazade, do you think you could tell us a story? And so she's the prompter at the beginning.
Yeah, And then, of course, she does. And then her sister says something to the effect of, wow, that was a really great story. And then Scheherazade says, you think that was good? Wait until tomorrow night, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's something of a motif in it. I mean, there's a group of stories known as the Hunchback Cycle, where each person is talking to save their life, and each one, as they come on, says, if you think that story was good, wait till you hear the next one. It's a real motif. You know, what's coming is even better than the last story.
That idea of one story unfolding inside of a story, that Hunchback series, there are a collection of those kinds of stories. What does that tell us about? I'm really interested in what this tells us about the culture of the time, or what that structure, what the meaning of that structure was. Do you think you understand that sensibility?
I'm not sure. The Hunchback Cycle of Stories is very artfully constructed, and like several other bunches of stories, one motif and one image plays against another. And the striking thing about the Hunchback group of stories is that there is no djinn, no magic, no flying horses or flying carpets. It's ordinary people doing ordinary business in the city who come to grief and often betrayed by wicked and beautiful women. But there's a kind of coherence to these stories, and they're quite different from many of the rest of the stories in the Arabian Nights. But as to the business of what is the point of the framing, I think possibly it has its origins in oral storytelling, that that a storyteller sits in a cafe and he starts telling the story of Scheherazade, and then he starts telling the story that Scheherazade is telling Sharia, and then he tells the story that's within that story, within that story. So people will come back the following night to hear, to get to the end of, you know, all the boxings. But you've gone down so many levels that I have to keep coming for quite a few nights before they get back to the beginning again, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. It's interesting. One thing you've talked about is that Scheherazade, a lot of people say she's this brilliant creative genius, which I suppose may be true, but you say she just has a really good memory.
Yes. She doesn't claim to be making the stories up, and she's clearly transmitting what she's heard. Yes, she's got an excellent memory. But of course, in those days, memory was, you know, enormously valued by medieval culture in a way that modern culture doesn't really value it. Anyway, and people who'd memorized the whole of the Quran were accorded at quite a degree of reverence. And there were also people called cup companions in Arabic, nudama, who had terrific memories and were paid to sit at the caliph's stable at dinner and tell stories and tell information and recite bits of the Quran and recite bits of poetry. They were sort of walking encyclopedias, but particularly of entertaining stories and witty remarks and poetic competition and so forth.
So they were part
so
of the
memory
repertoire.
Has a very high value in this culture.
Yeah. The stories that we know, a lot of Western culture knows today from Disney movies, for example, how much of a resemblance do they really bear to the originals, if at all?
Oh, it's pretty poor, really. I mean, I do like the Disney Aladdin. But if one looks at the Sinbad films, of which there are quite a lot, of course, yeah. There must be at least 30 Sinbad films. No, probably that's an underestimate. But you look at the Sinbad films, and there you've got Sinbad, and he's either a thief, a sort of charming rogue, or he's a prince in disguise, and he has a scimitar between his teeth, and he climbs the rigging, and he's a dauntless and fearless pirate. If you actually look at the Arab story, Sinbad is actually a tradesman. He's trading in basic commodities, and he's buying nutmeg and calico and coconuts and so forth in the East. He doesn't carry a sword. He couldn't climb the rigging to save his life. And any ship that he goes on is liable to sink because he carries so much bad luck with him. No, there's no real resemblance. Hollywood has invented its own Sinbad, who is quite a boring type of standard Hollywood hero. Going back to Aladdin, I do enjoy it. It's a very funny film. It's got very good music, the Disney Aladdin. But Princess Jasmine, when you think about it, is a bit of a disgrace. I mean, she sings a mission song early on in the thing, but then she does nothing. She just waits around and you know, finds Aladdin unsatisfactory in various ways, and then eventually, after he's done all sorts of heroic things, agrees to marry him, and after he's discovered himself, which is, again, is a very Hollywood thing and not there in the original story. But in the original story, the princess that Aladdin marries has got a lot of grit and spunk and actually kills kills the sorcerer who's stolen her away. You know, she really is somebody. But somehow the modern version is much less feminist.
I found that in Ali Baba, for example, at least the version that I looked at, a lot of really clever, cunning, sometimes violent women. And I wonder if that was a theme.
Yes. I mean, this is a good theme. It's a big theme. In a way, Ali Baba is misnamed. The story should really be called Marjana.
Exactly.
That's the slave girl, and she's the cunning one. And she spots that the thieves have hidden themselves in jars of oil. She spots that the thieves have been marking the house of Ali Baba and so forth. She's the real heroine, and Ali Baba is no kind of hero at all. He blunders into riches, and he's lucky to have her. More generally, the Arabian Nights teams with extraordinary, powerful, active, fighting women, and sometimes quite literally. So some of these women wear armour and ride about on horses and sort of challenge men to battle, kind of Amazons. And there's crafty Delilah, who's a master criminal who outwits the male criminals in Cairo. And Tawadud, who is the wisest woman in the world and plays a game of kind of intellectual strip poker with a series of scholars at the Abbasid court. And because she trumps them in her knowledge of medicine, astronomy and religious law and so forth, she forces one after another of them to strip. You've got all sorts of dynamic men and dynamic women, I should say. And when one looks at the men, they're often rather feckless and useless. And a very common theme in the openings of the stories is a young man who inherits his father's fortune and then fritters it all away on goodness knows, gambling and prostitutes or something. And then adventures start happening. And quite often with the help of a woman, he will eventually regain that fortune. But there's an awful lot of fecklessness among the men. I don't know why. Presumably it was a male audience that listened to this stuff. Why they were so happy for this to be the case, I'm not sure.
Well, that's what does that say? Tell you about this is one of the things that you actually write about. That is, you know, these were sophisticated, literate people. I mean, these weren't just these rustic tales necessarily, and these weren't just also about sorcerers and snake charmers and adulterers. There was something more complicated here going on.
There's all sorts of things to be said. Just this afternoon, I happened to have been reading a history of imperialism, and it was pointed out that when the French invaded Algeria in 1830, the Algerian rate of literacy was actually higher than that of the French at the time. The medieval Arab society was a highly literate one. When I wrote this book, I hadn't, at that stage, seen a whole cache of manuscripts that have turned up in a private collection in London, where they've got marks in the margins, and it emerges from those marks that these books were part of a circulating library, that scribe would set up a library, he'd write out the stories, and then he'd hire them out, and people would borrow them for a fee, and then return them, and quite often write comments in the margins, like, this doesn't make sense, or I really enjoyed this, or I've read this before. And because they sometimes give their names as well, we get some sense of the readership of these things. And they're artisans and merchants, as I was saying earlier. They're sort of, middle class. They're not the elite, but they're not the ignorant and the illiterate either. And the other aspect to the Arabian Nights, having said that, and which people tend to miss if they're Western readers, and I think I missed it myself when I first came to these stories, is that there's an awful lot of religion embedded in them. You know, partly it's a matter of, nobody starts an enterprise without saying Bismillah in the name of God, or if they do something wrong, Astaghfir Allah, I seek the forgiveness of God, and if things go well, Alhamdulillah. There's that. But there's also the idea that the marvellous is a gift of God, that if you see something extraordinary, that's an aspect of Allah's creativity. So when Sinbad sees all the strange things he does see, he gives praise to God, who's sort of endlessly inventive in creating marvellous islands, marvellous products and strange beasts. And the other sort of pious aspect to these stories is this: the notion of relief after grief. It's a very strong theme in Arab storytelling, that certain stories, if the protagonist must be patient. He will face hard times. But if he trusts in God and is patient, things will work out. And that is a theme of many of the stories, and particularly the Sinbad stories. But very few stories are without that theme running through them.
There's also
there's a lot of religion in it.
Yeah. Well, this idea of repentance comes up.
Yes. Yes, it's that is strong. The stories of the three dervishes who all end up with one eye and so on, sort of embedded within the tale of the Lady of Baghdad. They've all witnessed strange sexual acts and they've all come to grief. They've all infringed something or other and they've all paid the penalty and they've shaven their heads and become dervishes, having lost their eyes. Yes, repentance is a big theme.
You say the reader is supposed to take a warning from certain stories that power and wealth are only transitory, that in the end God will decide, I suppose.
Yeah, that's very much the theme of The City of Brass, a wonderful story where someone finds in the desert a jar containing a sealed jar which contains a jinn which was imprisoned in the jar by Solomon and brings it to the governor of Egypt. And the governor of Egypt says, well, there must be more of these jars out in the desert. Go and find me some. And so off an expedition goes. And it takes them ages to find the jars. But meanwhile, they find all these ruins and tombs and sort of sepulchres where the ruler boasts of his might. It's a bit like Ozymandias, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair, because it's just ruins all around. And then they come to this city of brass, which has no gates. And first, it's very difficult to get into. And people just die trying to. But with prayer, they manage it. And they find, yes, it was a great and splendid civilization, but they insulted God and they face doom and the place is just filled with corpses and the princess sits on her throne and she seems alive because there's quicksilver in her eye sockets, but she's as dead as the rest. And yeah, and then so repent and, you know, no matter how much wealth you have, trust in God, that is better for you.
What do you think you mentioned jinn, and I think a lot of us mean a genie is the other way of putting that. Do you what do you think you understand about what the jinn, the genie represents in these stories? Because that's another motif that you see all the time.
Yes. I was once being interviewed by some other program and I I let slip that I'd seen a jinn myself while I was in a dervish monastery in Algeria. the thing about the jinn is that unlike fairies in Western folk tales have always been quite widely dismissed by the intelligentsia. The jinn are actually testified to in the Quran. They feature several times. So no Muslim can deny the existence of the jinn. So they are a reality and a daily reality for many people. I've known quite a lot of people who've seen jinn or had dealings with jinn. It seems a strange thing. But they're within the stories, they're a mechanism for the marvellous. Es Bayat's got a marvellous passage somewhere in one of her novellas where she describes them as this kind of engines of dreams. They set up an irrational narrative and they control the people in the story who then behave as if they're in an irrational dream. And they sort of watch over us, yes. And the thing about the jinn is they're not demons exactly, because there's sometimes good jinn as well as bad jinn. And indeed, there are Muslim jinn and there are Christian jinn and there are, bad jinn. And they have no particular, there's no single appearance. You can never be sure you've seen a jinn. I mean, some of them look absolutely hideous, but on the other hand, some of them choose to look very handsome and very human. There's no telling with jinn.
Robert Irwin is with us. He's the author of The Arabian Nights, A Companion, wrote the introduction for Penguin's 3-volume translation of The Arabian Nights. We should also mention, just because it sort of applies here, that Ballet West is staging an adaptation of Aladdin, which runs April 3rd through the 5th. For details about that, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org again. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Robert Irwin. We're talking about The Arabian Nights. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. Well, you mentioned just how vast the types of stories are in The Arabian Nights. Wisdom literature and fables and pornography, as you say, it's a lot of scatological kinds of jokes. The sex part, there's a lot of sex in there, suffused with sex. Talk a little bit about that element of these stories.
Yeah, I should preface it by saying that the sex gets exaggerated by some of the translators, particularly Richard Burton's English translation and Madras's French translation. They add extra bits of eroticism and sadism and goodness knows what. But yes, the sex is there, and it's something that's made, frankly, it's made the Arabian Nights quite unpopular in Arab culture among the intelligentsia for centuries. It was disregarded, partly because of its poor style, but also because, yes, all this sexual content, which was extremely disapproved of, and you know, it really seemed to run against the religion, but it kept the audiences happy, clearly. I don't know what else one should say about this.
Well, one thing that's interesting, and I'm not sure if it just had to do with the sex part, obviously, but you've mentioned at some point or another that the original manuscripts of some of these stories just disintegrated because people were using them so much. I mean, they were very popular.
Yes, very popular. Very popular, but not among the elite. The elite thought, you know, this is impious, this is time-wasting, this is actually poor grammar. God, even the handwriting is bad on most of the manuscripts. It's pretty grotty stuff. It's pulp fiction, as it were. It's like a sort of rather cheap comic book. And it's not until really the 20th century that a section of the Arab intelligentsia, the novelists and poets in the Arab world, pick up on the Arabian Nights and say, yes, this really is part of our culture and we're proud of it, and it's a potential source of inspiration for future fiction and future poetry.
So the creative class, they're the ones that ultimately embraced it.
But there's still move. Every now and again, there's a move to ban the Arabian Nights. There was one in the Lebanon about 20 years ago, and more recently, about 4 or 5 years ago in Egypt, there was an attempt to ban unbolderized versions of the Arabian Nights by religiously minded people.
You've talked about how the mysteries and the magic in some of these stories can be among your favorites. And I wanted to ask about some of the stories that you've written about. There's the story of the three apples. Why don't you tell that story and talk a little bit about that?
I can't remember it well enough. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No, that's okay.
But from my memory, it is a detective story. And what you get in the Arabian Nights again and again is this. If I remember the three apples, at the beginning they find a corpse, a woman in a coffin, and Harun says to Jaffa, his vizier, sort this out, find out what happened. So there's a sense of mystery, of a problem, and it's very potent in a lot of these stories. What on earth is going on? It happens with the Ladies of Baghdad sequence of stories, where while the various people who've dropped in on the three ladies are being entertained, one of the ladies brings forth a pair of dogs and starts whipping them, and then weeps as she does so, and then cuddles the dogs, having whipped them. You think, what? Why? What is the explanation? And subsequently, when I came to read the stories, Conan Doyle's stories of Sherlock Holmes, it's hard not to believe that he was not very, very strongly influenced by the Arabian Nights, setting up something really strange, like the gathering of red-headed men who summoned copy out bits from an encyclopedia. You know, what is going on? What could possibly be the explanation? That is what the Arabian Nights plays with. It's the appeal of the three apples stories and a lot of the other ones. Yes, there's, for instance, the one of Harun al-Rashid, who goes out. He's often bored, so he goes out wandering through the streets of Baghdad, and he comes to the river, and there he sees a great boat lit up and full of servants and so on. And he asks the people who are standing by the riverbank, who's that going along in the boat? And they tell him, oh, it's the Caliph Harun al-Rashid. He always sails by at this time. You think, eh? Why? How come? So there are a lot of stories like that.
I won't put you on the spot.
So the origins of the detective story might be with the Arabian Nights, just as the origins of fantasy also with the Arabian Nights.
Yeah. I won't put you on the spot by asking about the story of the multicolored fish caught in this net of a poor fisherman, but that's another mystery.
That is, again, a marvellous story. It's never fully explained. I think that story is defectively told. I mean, the fisherman catches these coloured fish. You know, why are they all different colours? He takes them along to the Caliph. The Caliph says, okay, let's see what they taste like. So they're taken down to the kitchen, and the woman is starting to fry them in the kitchen when a woman carrying a wand bursts through the wall of the kitchen and says, "Fish, fish, are you faithful to your contract?" And the fishes reply from the frying pan, "Yes, we're faithful to our contract." You think, eh? And it's the beginning of an extraordinary story, which sort of rambles off and takes the caliph or the prince to a palace where he finds a prince who's sitting immobile in on a throne, and he's immobile because his lower half has been turned to stone. So the mystery, one mystery has led on to another mystery, and it takes quite a lot to disentangle it all.
Do you have to, when you're reading these stories, do you just have to give way to them, not try to make sense with your own kind of cultural sensibility, but try to just sort of follow along and take what you can from them?
Yes, though with the caveat that, frankly, some of the stories are pretty poor. You can't bung in hundreds of stories, and yeah. I think there's something like, there are over 300 at least. And some of them are not that good and, should be read with a critical eye. And some of them ramble on and have all sorts of implausibilities. But, yes, sometimes things happen that are never explained in the stories, and sometimes they're the best bits. What on earth is going on here? Like the story of Judah and his brethren, never mind the brethren, they come later in the stories, but Judah is fishing in a lake outside Cairo, and a Moorish sorcerer comes up to him and says, "I want you to tie me up and throw me in the river. And if I surface three times but then don't surface again, you can take all my property and sell it to a Jewish dealer in town." And that he does that, and then a few days later the brother turns up and insists on also being thrown tied up into the river. And it's a marvellous and mysterious beginning to an extraordinary story.
What's with all the locked rooms in these stories?
Yeah, well, that's a game, isn't it? Which story is it? It's one of the three dervish stories, and he comes to this castle. It's inhabited by 40 women, and he has a lovely time with them. And then the leader of the women says to him, "Well, we're going away for a few days, but you have the complete run of the palace. There's lots of food, there's lots of everything. You may go into any room in the palace except this one, the locked room, the forbidden room." And, they're setting things up, isn't it? You don't want this prince to go through into the locked room because he's been forbidden to and bad things will happen. On the other hand, if he doesn't go through the locked room, it's going to be a jolly boring story because he's going to sit there eating food. So there's a kind of tension in the listener, and this using the interdiction to create a tension is one of the things the storytellers of the Arabian Nights do quite a bit. Whatever you do, don't do this. Sinbad is carried up by, I can't remember if it's a bird or an angel, into the air. No, I think it's a djinn. And whatever you do, don't mention the name of God. But of course, having been told he mustn't, that is exactly what he does, and he's promptly dropped to earth again.
You see these things.
The interdiction is a challenge.
Yeah. Sorry. The Uncle Remus stories. I'm not sure if you've studied much of those from the American South. They have the same kind of elements, Br'er Rabbit. These sort of playful characters and you being drawn in and tempted to do the things you're not supposed to be doing.
Yeah, a Beatrix Potter in England, yeah. Tales of Peter Rabbit. Whatever you do, don't go into Mr. McGregor's garden.
Right,
okay, so oh God, he's going to go into McGregor's garden. Oh God, it's going to be frightening.
Well, one of the things, there are good translations and there are bad translations. In one of your books, in the introduction, you mentioned that while reading Sir Richard Burton's translation, you thought you might slit your throat rather than continue on.
Yes. It's a verdict that has not changed. The more I study Burton's translation, the more I realize what a very bad translation it is. I mean, apart from the inaccuracies and the inventions, the bits he adds, and the very tiresome footnotes, which are full of erotic irrelevances. It's just the writing is so very bad. The syntax is so strained and he uses such a weird vocabulary. And it was to a degree plagiarized from John Payne's earlier translation and also from Edward William Lane's much earlier translation. It is just about unreadable, but it was the most, at the time I read it, it was the most substantial translation of the Arabian Nights that was available in English. I mean, it had the most stories. And in that respect, it was useful, but my God, it was an ordeal. I'd started, having been commissioned by Penguin to do the Arabian Nights companion, I started reading the Arabian Nights from cover to cover, all 17 volumes in the Burton thing, wow. thinking, isn't this nice? I'm being paid to read fairy stories. And then I sort of realised, well, they weren't fairy stories, that's for a start, and it wasn't nice at all. It was just going on and on and on in Burton's terrible style. Things have got better. Penguin, a few years ago, published a new translation by Malcolm Lyons, which is in decent English for the first time.
But you've said Lane's translation, I heard you describe it on the BBC as awful, pseudo-biblical, pre-Tolkien, grandiose prose. And you think that some of those bad translations actually killed the Arabian Nights as literature in some cases.
I do. Lane is ridiculous. One of the things with Lane is he kept dropping stories. And at the beginning, he kept saying, well, this one's not suitable for women and children, or this is not suitable for the illiterate and poor people who might read it, and it might be okay for members of the social elite. But eventually he keeps dropping, and some stories he says he's dropping because they're not very good. But in the end, I've worked out that what was going on was he's coming under pressure from the publisher, who's losing money from this, and saying, can't you bring the story collection to an end as quickly as possible, because we're not making money here. Sorry, what was the question again? I've lost it there.
The bad translations may have killed.
Yes. Indeed. The Gallon translation, he made a lot of mistakes. He was working in the beginning of the 18th century. It's understandable he should make mistakes. He didn't have a decent dictionary. He didn't have an encyclopedia of Islam. There was practically nobody in France who knew Arabic, so he didn't have many people he could rely on. There wasn't a university department dealing in Arabic. No. So, he was on his own, and he did quite a good job. And because there wasn't any kind of serious academic audience, he had to aim it at the court ladies of Versailles and Paris. And so he made it very readable. And the English translation from Gallon's French, which was also done at the very beginning of the 18th century, is quite a good translation. It reads quite decently, considering how old it is. It reads better than the Lane and the Burton translations, which came in the Victorian period. They're much less readable than the 18th century translation.
But you've said that Gallon thought that he was giving people a real sense of how the Middle East worked. I mean, that.
It's a little bit. Gallon, if one reads what Gallon says, it's not just the Middle East. He thought it was a guide to the whole of the Orient. Throwing in China, Southeast Asia, and India. He thought this is a kind of fictional encyclopedia. It followed directly on from the Bibliothèque Orientale of d'Herblay, which was a kind of literary encyclopedia of the Middle East. So Gallon thought that way. And then when Lane does his translation in the 1830s, he sees it as a guide quite specifically to modern Cairo, forgetting that there was sort of in the stories there are gin and rocks and flying carpets and stuff, which I don't believe he found in the Cairo of his time. And then when Burton does his, he thinks that Lane's emphasis on it being a guide to Egypt was a bit ridiculous. And what it really, as much as anything, it was a guide not only to the Middle East, but also to India, where Burton had spent the first part of his career. And so there's a lot of footnotes in Burton that have Indian references. And sort of, when I was in India, I saw something just like this sort of stuff.
And so where... How are people thinking about them today? I mean, what sort of stereotypes, impressions, ideas of the Middle East do these, and what do these stories really tell us about the Middle East, at least in terms of the contemporary society today, if anything?
I was thinking about this quite recently, and I was thinking, when people went out to the Middle East in the 19th century, Thackeray and Twain and Melville, and Trollope, all sorts of people, and they arrive in Istanbul and say, why, it's just like a scene from the Arabian Nights. And they get to Alexandria, it's just like the Arabian Nights. And, in Cairo, the Arabian Nights has come to life again. It was such a cliche, and they see the Middle East through the eyes of the Arabian Nights. People don't do that anymore. They stopped doing it in the course of the 20th century. And the reason is they stopped reading the Arabian Nights. And what we're left with, if you're talking to the average person, is they might have a vague idea of the story of Scheherazade and Shahryar, but a very vague one. And they think they know the stories of Aladdin, Sinbad and Ali Baba. Just those three, really. And they're the subject of pantomimes and films and children's books. And not much else has got through to the popular consciousness. Only a few writers in the West have read a lot of the Arabian Nights. Salman Rushdie would be one example. A.S. Byatt would be another. Marina Warner another. But it's quite a minority of writers who one can find a discernible influence of the Arabian Nights on what they've written.
Here's an email.
So it's not much.
Yeah. Here's an email from Liz, who writes from Leighton, Utah. She says, I'm currently producing an original theatrical adaptation of The Arabian Nights to be performed this fall at a local high school here. She says, during our production process, I heard a concern voiced over events happening in the Middle East and Muslim countries, which may make the idea of the show unpalatable to our prospective audience. We proceeded to develop the concept, to complete the script, and to move forward, she says. But I found that one of the themes in The Arabian Nights is that we come to know each other and appreciate each other better through the stories that we tell. Do you think that's true? I mean, you're a sort of a heretic, as you said earlier, on the idea of some unifying theme here. But do you see that in some of these stories?
I think The Arabian Nights sort of widens people's horizons, that it sort of makes them receptive to different ways of doing things, so that the protagonists in these stories encounter the Amazons, women in charge, that's extraordinary, or they encounter the people who live in the sea, that too is extraordinary, but it's understandable, and it's explained how society under the sea is organised and so on. So it encourages a kind of, yes, breadth of vision.
Robert Irwin is with us, the author of The Arabian Nights, A Companion. He wrote the introduction for Penguin's 3-volume translation of The Arabian Nights. And he's joining us from the BBC in London. We'll take a quick break and be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Robert Irwin. We're talking about The Arabian Nights. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. One of the things you write about Robert Irwin is the point that these stories are told at night. Stories are best told at night. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, well, it was a cultural feature of the Middle East that it was regarded as really rather disreputable to spend time telling or listening to stories in daytime. One should be working at that point. And I suppose these stories, many of them are sort of trying to approximate to the kind of weird power of dreams, and so they have a best effect at night. But could I come back to something that was raised by the person you're quoting just before the break? Thinking about the relationship of the Arabian Nights to the modern Middle East, I think the Arabian Nights, for all it's got lots of stories about thieves and con men and adulterers and despots and sorcerers, it somehow embodies a more innocent version of the Middle East than the one we have today, one that is much more tolerant, certainly in the core stories. They're very relaxed about Christians and Jews, and one that's very confident of its cultural superiority, and rightly so. It was a much more literate society than anything comparable in Europe. So it's something to look back on with nostalgia, really. Islam's important, but it doesn't totally dominate. It isn't a political force in these stories. Anyway.
What are your favorites? Do they change from time to time?
They do a bit. I do like The City of Brass, which you've mentioned, and Judah and His Brethren, which you've mentioned. Oh, the story of Sage Duban and King Yunan is a wonderful story. I think probably I can tell it. The king is very ill, and various physicians can't cure him, but Sage Duban turns up and gives the king a special polo mallet and tells him to play polo, and he does, and after a few games of polo, he is mysteriously cured. He doesn't understand why, and the sage explains that he's put a special potion in the polo mallet so that when the king sweats, the sweat mingles with the potion, and so he's cured. Well, from then on, the sage is highly favoured and becomes the king's top favourite, but that means he creates lots of enemies, and they spread scandals against him, and eventually they persuade the king to execute him, at which point the sage presents himself before King Yunan and says, well, I'm sorry, you're going to execute me, but there it goes. But I'd like to give you this book. It's got some amazing spells in it. I think you should read it. So then they lop off the sage's head, and the sage's head on the leather mat, which you use for executions, speaks to the king. "Now, O king, open the book and read what is there." And the king sort of tries to open. The pages are a bit stuck, so he licks his fingers. And as he licks his fingers, he ingests the poison with which the book is suffused. And so the sage's head is able to witness the death of the man who sentenced him to death. It's a very nice, compact story.
Well, let's go back to Scheherazade finally here. It ends fairly well for Scheherazade. She basically, depending on which version you want to sort of go with, I mean, she basically wears out the king, I guess.
Yes, perhaps he says, "Oh no, Scheherazade, I've had enough stories. Let's call it a day." Yes, but she bears him 3 children in the course of this 1001 nights. That's as much as anything is why he, in quotes, forgives her. Yeah,
right. But it's interesting to hear other people have their version of that story, which is to say that, and you hear this a lot. I mean, that the king becomes over the course of time enlightened or enchanted, yeah, and he gets this sense of empathy because he's now for the first time paying attention to all these stories and these people.
Yeah, but there's no textual, no good textual evidence for that. There is one ending of the Arabian Nights in one version where Scheherazade starts to tell the story of a despotic king who's betrayed by his wife and then decides to sleep with a virgin every night, and then a story to, and there you go again. You see that the story of Scheherazade is being framed within the story of Scheherazade's storytelling. It's a kind of nightmarish circularity to it. And Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentinian short story writer, loved that. As he would.
Well, isn't that the case, though, that everyone, some love that sort of circular element to it. Some see virtue in it. Some like the vice parts of it. I guess maybe that's the real draw for these stories, is we can sort of take what we want from them, I suppose.
Yeah, sort of in the 18th century, they took all sorts of moral lessons about Christian virtue from these stories, and they extracted it with some difficulty. But that's what Addison and Johnson and people like that did. But come the 20th century, we're all into sort of, not all, but many key writers are into sort of modernist games playing and literary, you know, self-reference and so on. Not just Borges, but John Barth and Proust to an extent, and James Joyce, playing all sorts of sophisticated games with something that really, although it's lovely, is much less sophisticated.
Didn't Richard Burton, didn't he add a bit about the sister, about Scheherazade's sister in his story? Did I get that right?
I didn't notice that. What I did notice that, whereas when Shahryar discovers that his wife is adulterous, she finds she's been sleeping with a black slave, the story just leaves it at that, whereas Burton's translation has the queen sleeping with a filthy scullion coated with kitchen grease and grime. And Burton goes on and on about how revolting he is. You know, it's pure invention. It's typical of Burton. A lot of the translators, I mean, Gallon's as guilty in a way as Burton, seen it as their duty to improve the original. You know, the Arabic's not that good. No reason why I can't make a better fist of it. And Gallon took it for granted that anything that could be translated to French was bound to be improved by the mere fact of being in French. And it was his duty to make it into graceful prose, even if the grace wasn't there in the original text. It's rather patronizing.
Scheherazade, of course, is telling these stories in order to postpone her death. But it's interesting, in one of the introductions you write about that kind of parallel between Scheherazade being motivated to tell these stories to save her life, and in some way our own stories that we tell are also told on some level to postpone death. Would you say something about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. Perhaps we read stories in order to put off thinking about death, even stories like those in the Arabian Nights where people are telling stories to ward off death. I don't know. No, I'm not sure what I think about that.
In your book, The Arabian Nights, A Companion, you write that nobody really knows when, of course, these stories began, or for that matter, and you referenced this earlier, when they will end. What do you mean by that? Are we still adding to those stories?
Well, yes, in a way. Let me think. S. Byatt's novella, The Gin in the Peacock's Eye, could be seen as an addition. Salman Rushdie's Haroon and the Sea of Stories, John Barth's Chimera, my own Arabian Nightmare. Also short stories. There are a whole string of famous authors like Edgar Allan Poe who wrote the story of the Thousand and Second Night. Yeah, so people keep adding things. And the films, I suppose, also add storytelling elements. And some of the films are excellent. I shouldn't finish this program without mentioning Pasolini's excellent Il Fiore delle Mille e Una Notte, Flower of the Thousand and One Nights. It's the closest to the original text of all the films, and it's visually very beautiful, as well as being reliable as sort of what the stories are like. And Pasolini's very clear that there's a kind of truth in the Arabian Nights, but it's like in dreams. The truth does not lie in one dream, but in many dreams.
It's Robert Irwin. Among his books on Arabic literature and art is The Arabian Nights, A Companion. Most recently, he wrote the introduction for a collection of medieval Arab fantasies called Tales of the Marvelous and News of the Strange. And Robert Irwin joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Robert Irwin, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Should also mention the Ballet West is performing an adaptation of Aladdin April 3rd through the 5th. You can get details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.